I'm Bob Oakes, in for Chris Lydon. This is The Connection. The Rampart Police Corruption Report in Los Angeles and the Diallo Verdict in New York provide fundamental questions about policing. The Rampart anti-gang unit in L.A. was in effect operating outside the law. Innocent people were intimidated, physically abused, and framed. Not for the first time, police in L.A. are suspect. Maybe now their image as protectors is tarnished beyond recognition. In New York, citizens are outraged that tougher tactics to reduce street crime has resulted in the death of an innocent man. The group Human Rights Watch says police brutality is one of the most serious, enduring, and divisive human rights violations in the United States. In large cities all over America, more cops are on the streets, but not everybody feels safer. Police officers across the country are being accused of crossing the thin blue line. We're talking this hour about who's policing the police, why there's such resistance to external review. More police are on the streets, but are they being trained and supervised? 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, makes The Connection this hour. Joining us in the studio is Frank Hartman, director of the Program on Criminal Justice at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Welcome.
Thank you, Bob.
And also joining us by phone from Stanford University is Joseph McNamara, former police chief in Kansas City, San Jose, and now a fellow at the Hoover Institute. Good morning.
Good morning.
And from Champaign, Illinois, where I believe he's sitting in the police department right now, Christopher Cooper, a former Washington, D.C. police officer and a board member of the National Black Police Association. How are you?
Hello.
Thanks for being with us. Let's start with a question. Let's start with a question of how bad is it out there? How bad is the corruption and the abuse? Is this is what we're reading in the last few weeks something that's prevalent, or are these isolated incidents? Do you want to start here in the studio?
Sure. Bob, the answer is we don't know. The fact is the police have been so reluctant to measure these kinds of things, to talk about them, to disclose them, that we know very little about the actual data. The only data that we do have are the number of shootings by police. But the fact is we don't even know how to make the distinction between justified shootings and unjustified shootings. But if one measures just shootings in New York City, last year the police shot and killed 19 persons. In early 1980s, they shot and killed 35 persons. In the late 60s, early 70s, in a specific year, they shot and killed 65 persons. So the one measurable piece of data that you have about police shootings and killing people clearly is going in the right direction. You wish it were zero instead of 19, but it's going in the right direction. At the same time as you have those data going in the right direction, you have anger increasing. So I'm willing to bet that there was less outrage about the 65 killings in 1969 than there is about the 19 shootings in the year 1999. But for the most part, the issues that go on between police and citizens don't reach the level of homicides. Really, it's disrespect, it's abuse, it's sometimes physical, it's sometimes verbal, but we don't know anything about it because the police have been so reluctant to talk about it or to let anyone in to look at it.
Joe McNamara, what's your take on this?
Well, I agree in general, although I have been doing some research which has really disturbed me greatly because when I've looked back through the years, I've seen thousands and thousands of what I call gangster crimes. I'm writing a book on gangster cops, The Hidden Cost of America's War on Drugs. And what you find is city after city across the country have had incidents where the police have, instead of just taking payoffs from gangsters in the drug crimes, they have been the gangsters committing murders and kidnapping and armed robberies and stealing drugs and selling drugs. Now, of course, it's a very small percentage of the total number of officers, but the enormous damage they do, such as the revelations in Los Angeles by former narcotics detective Rafael Perez, has plunged the LAPD into their worst scandal in 40 years. So you have this going on. It's not really been perceived as a national problem, but it is a national problem. It's not perceived that way because policing is so local that these kind of terrible cases arise for a couple of days in the media. Typically, the mayor and police chief say it's just a few rotten apples, and we've corrected the condition. However, you have to understand that it's going on someplace else the next week, or maybe right in the same department at the same time, or a year later. So there is a pattern there that's very disturbing. And what's also very disturbing about it is these gangster cops have gone on committing their crimes, sometimes stealing millions of dollars from drug dealers over a period of years, and the code of silence has protected them. So these are pretty disturbing pictures to see. I agree that we can't really measure this as we could annual rainfall or something like that. But the other thing that's clear is there's a very aggressive style of policing, a confrontational style of policing, that is really beginning to bring about a great deal of rebellion in minority neighborhoods, as it should. And I think this is the root cause of when we see the Diallo shooting and the kind of things that the Rampart division and other division crash officers in Los Angeles were doing. This really has aroused the community, and it shows a kind of contempt and a disrespect for minority males by the police that is extremely damaging.
Hang on, Joe. Chris Cooper, where are you?
First of all, I just wanted to point out, I am a PhD, a doctor of sociology, and I have been studying policing for a considerable amount of time. This is in addition to my role in the National Black Police Association. I want to disagree with Dr. Hartman's position. Dr. Hartman's position is what's referred to as a pure sociological position. What he's saying is that if we can't quantify the phenomenon of police abuse, then perhaps it doesn't exist.
I did not say that.
Okay, but that's really what's happening here, because there is.
But don't put me in that camp.
Yeah, but there's a great deal. There is a great deal of data. We know that the rotten apple theory, okay, does not adequately describe the situation right now in the U.S. We have a great many self-reports. If we talk to black and Latino people, we realize that police abuse is a systemic problem in the United States. The rotten apple theory certainly doesn't define what's happening. But second, most important, we have a great deal of information already, enough information to realize that we have a problem. The anecdotal data is certainly present. Yes, homicide is not the most common type of abuse. However, there is a great deal of serious abuse. But the other thing that needs to be considered is this, because Dr. Hartman, you point out that we can't distinguish between a bad shoot and a good shoot. Consider this.
Okay? I didn't say that, Joe. I said with the data that we had about the 19, the 35, and the 65, I don't know how to justify. And Joe McNamara said, you can't measure it. We have not measured it. We should measure it, and we haven't measured it.
What needs to be considered is this. The police officer has a great deal of latitude when it comes to using deadly force. We need to be concerned about those police officers who adhere to the minimum criteria allowed to use deadly force. That is, a police officer is in a situation where he or she knows that deadly force policy will allow him to shoot, but he or she also knows that he or she does not have to shoot. He or she knows that there are alternatives, but yet the officer shoots anyway because he or she knows that he or she will be justified, that the shooting will be ruled a good shooting, to use police jargon. And the sad part is, okay, that many black and Latino youth, okay, are often the individuals subjected to this minimum criteria use of deadly force policy.
So is that how the race factor plays in, do you think, Chris?
Absolutely. We're talking about police officers who see a flicker of a green light from use of deadly force policy. This is what happened in Hartford. This is why Aquan Salmon is dead. This is why Sergeant Cornell Young, shot by his fellow officers in Providence, is dead. Okay, I speak to you as a police sociologist who has done a great deal of research in this area. I speak to you as a member of the National Black Police Association, an advocacy group for black communities when it comes to policing issues, as well as for black police officers.
What's your view on why the green light goes on?
Why? Because it's a marginalization of black life. Our lives are not seen as to have the same value as white life. We're talking about some white police officers, not all police officers, who marginalize our lives, our right to live and function on this planet.
Let's come back to the studio. Frank Hartman, where are you on this?
Well, I don't know how to react to that, because he's just taken the high moral ground, and clearly the minority population suffers most from police brutality. There's no question about this, but he just sort of laid it out as if this is a fiat. The fact is, if we accept the fact that there is much more police brutality and police abuse than we'd like, that we haven't measured it, we should be measuring it, and we should be measuring its effect. And that the question is, how do you reduce it? And I suspect that one of the ways that will lead to the reduction of this is making the whole process more open. So, for example, there is a Midwest restaurant chain that has the kitchens as part of the dining area. And their motto is, if it's in sight, it must be right. The fact is, police behavior is hidden from the public, and the police know that these incidents like the Diallo shooting and the Hartford shooting that Chris mentions will go away after a while, because the media will just turn its attention from that. The issue is, how do you get the police to finally say, look, we need to act in public? It's a profession that's scared because it believes the public will not finally trust them or justify them if everything that happens is in public. And we just have to break through that, and it's probably going to be led by police, because police will just hunker down and circle the wagons until they, in fact, agree to do this.
Joseph McNamara, if you shine the light of day on the internal workings of police departments, do you eliminate the jobs, so to speak, of the gangsta cops that you were talking about earlier?
I don't think you can totally eliminate that. And I think what's most important right now is to examine the culture of different departments. I think there is a tendency for police in certain areas, minority neighborhoods, to dehumanize the people that they're dealing with, whether they're gangs or teenagers. And I think this has not only been tolerated, but it's been promoted by mayors and by police chiefs and by police management, not overtly, but the fact that 41 shots are fired at Mr. Diallo, an unarmed, innocent man in his own hallway, is something that just shouldn't happen.
Well, how are the cops?
It happens because the police were sent out onto the street, just like the Rampart crash units. These units have a culture within the police culture that is even more contemptuous and dehumanizing toward the people that they are supposed to be serving. And so I think there is that element of race there, that some white officers perceive minority males to be more dangerous. Some of them are bigots, and I think it's part of a general sense of policing that we're in a war against drugs, a war against crime. And once the cops think they're soldiers in a war, they develop a military mindset instead of the correct one, that they are peace officers, and their duty is not as an occupation army, but to protect and serve the community regardless of its affluence, race, or culture. And I think that vision has been lost from policing, as we've seen in a number of cities, the mayors boasting about how, and police chiefs as well, how they brought crime down through this extremely aggressive kind of policing, where the police see everyone walking the streets as a suspect, as they did with Mr. Diallo. He wasn't doing anything, but he was a suspect because he was in that neighborhood, and unconsciously, although race wasn't raised in that trial, I'm sure the race factor is there either consciously or unconsciously.
Are the words protect and serve on the crest of the Los Angeles Police Department? I seem to remember that. But what you're saying is, if I've got you correctly, what you're saying is that the motto on a crest anywhere, if it's protect and serve, has simply been overpowered by the empowering notion that for two decades, politician after politician after politician after politician have told us we're locked in a war on drugs.
Yes, I think that's most unfortunate because the police are not going to be able to stop drug use. The fact is that opium production and cocaine production abroad has increased greatly, and 90% of those drugs come into the country undetected. So it's a war that the cops didn't declare, and it's one that they can't win. And in trying to do so, they toss aside the Bill of Rights and feel that, well, everyone knows you can't enforce the drug laws and without violating the Fourth Amendment. So perjury has become so prevalent that they joke about it in the NYPD and call it test the lying instead of testifying.
Right.
And in Los Angeles, it's called joining the Liars Club. Now, that's sort of the first step for some of these officers.
First of all, I want to say I agree with everything that Dr. McNamara has put on the table, and I've always agreed with Dr. McNamara. I'm very supportive of his writings. I want to bring up 2 points. First, with regard to the latter statements by Dr. McNamara and this issue of testifying and the police subculture, realize that we're dealing with a police subculture in the U.S. where good police officers, honest police officers, are afraid to come forward and to talk about the malfeasance that they witness, to talk about what's wrong in policing. Because typically what police departments will do is turn around and charge the good officer or threaten to charge a good officer with perjury. So just look at what's happening here. There are plenty of cases. The Boria case in New York, for instance, she came forward and testified that Francis Lavoti and a group of officers concocted a story to explain how Anthony Baez died. Boria was told that she would be charged with perjury. Another issue, and this ties into Dr. McNamara's comments, we should consider what the scholars in America have not been doing. In other words, the sociologists and the political scientists have been publishing study after study which suggests that post-Serpico and that post-civil rights, the racism in America is no longer a factor, that police corruption is no longer a factor. In other words, the sense that police corruption went away right after Serpico. And what's happened is, in the research, you see an ignorance of the reality of policing. I blame my own colleagues in sociology, specifically police scholars, for not showing through empirical data that police malfeasance is still a problem. We've contributed to this problem.
What do you mean by an ignorance of the reality of policing?
Well, in other words, when we go out and when I say we, I'm talking about many sociologists, but not myself, to go out and to study a phenomenon without use of the proper methodologies that would reveal that even post-Serpico, there are still officers who go out here and shoot people who they know they shouldn't shoot. There are still officers who go out here and steal from scenes. I mean, there is this idealist notion in the sociological community, specifically among police sociologists, that this is all something of the past. I mean, consider that when Willie Williams was told right before going to L.A. about the extent of corruption in his police department, he laughed at it. He basically told the victims, you're watching too much television. This couldn't be happening in my department. And he was in L.A. when one of the largest scandals in the history of this country broke in Philadelphia. And it turned out that approximately 2,000 blacks had been targeted by a group of white officers who concocted charges, one of which was charging a grandmother with running a crack distribution business. She spent 3 years in prison, although she appealed to Willie Williams and he wouldn't listen.
Before we go to the phones, I want to ask Frank Hartman one other question. Frank, where are you on this notion that that somehow the war on drugs has empowered bad behavior on the part of some police officers in some police departments?
Well, I think that the term war has been the wrong term from the get-go, because in effect it's a war on ourselves, it's a war on our children, it's a war on our brothers and our sisters, and so it's a terrible term. I'm not sure that the whole anti-drug effort, both within policing and in a larger arena of the Federal Bureau and of the Immigration Bureau and of the Coast Guard and of the Navy and everything else and so forth, that's so much an issue about police brutality as it is about the kind of corruption that comes by reason of access to great sums of money. So that it feels to me as if that the drug war, we don't like the term, but if that whole drug wrestling match, if you will, that it's been less an issue promoting police corruption in terms of physical abuse than it is police corruption in terms of, well, there's $100,000 sitting there that nobody's watching, and so I'm going to take it. So it's made accessible to the police an immense amount of cash, which is corrupting of a certain number of individuals. So it's another loss to the integrity of policing.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Let's take a couple of calls before the break. Ms. Rack, you're on The Connection. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me. I'm a social worker who work with police officers, and I have seen some nice ones who really care. At the same time, I have seen the worst also. I'm just wondering the hiring of the police officers, if it's anywhere near requirements for the police to have, like BA in sociology or some kind of social work, especially the one, who are out there on the street and have been given responsibility of human life. Recently, a guy from Africa came in. He's a student. He's about 20 outside on the summer, standing on Tremont Street. 10 o'clock at night, the police came in, check his pocket, and I went outside and I said, "What are you doing?" So they said, "Well, they thought he was he looked like some suspect. This guy was just standing there. He thought he still live in Africa, standing outside on the street." And I told them, "This is just enjoying the night out, but I guess it's illegal for him to stand here." So they just left. This happening at the same time I have seen.
May I respond to your question?
What I'd like to do is ask Joe McNamara, who as a former police chief has hired police officers, his view on what he's looking for in a good officer when he's trying to hire, and whether today we need to be looking at things in a different way when we bring people onto the force and into the academies.
Well, I think we first of all need to look at the person's record. It would be nice if we could hire only college graduates, but I would be unwilling to do that if we had to sacrifice the diversity that's needed. I've written earlier saying that anyone who thinks we can police inner cities with white cops from the suburbs is quite foolish. And I do think it's extremely important for people to see that the police force does represent the community that is being policed. But what you really need to do when you're looking at candidates is to look at their background. If they have any sign of violence, any sign of being psychologically unbalanced, then the decision to hire or not to hire should be made in favor of public safety, and we shouldn't hire people who are questionable, because it is extremely difficult to fire a police officer because they have civil service tenure, and as has been indicated, their colleagues will not testify against them because they do so at the peril of being ostracized and worse with their peers. And so recruiting is an increasing problem, because with the employment at such a high level and the economy booming and lots of really good paying job opportunities, the police across the country are having difficulty, especially in areas where you have a thriving computer or high-tech industry. But I still go back to the fact that I think it's a big mistake to blame this on binge hiring, on a few rotten apples. These are the traditional excuses that police chiefs and mayors have right. given, when in fact it's the kind of political and police leadership that has not only condoned this confrontational style of policing, but encouraged it. I heard Mayor Giuliani on television say that Amadou Diallo's death was a tragic accident, and compare it to a traffic accident. And so how can you be surprised that you that green light that was mentioned for some very small number of officers pick up vibrations from City Hall and from the police chief that they are justified in this kind of aggression, and they're paranoid about the amount of danger that they're in, and who suffers? People, I mean, it's just unthinkable that in the United States of America, the police will shoot people reaching for their driver's license or their cell phone.
Chief McNamara, let's let Chris Cooper weigh in here. He wanted to jump in a moment
and
ago.
Again, I want to say again, I agree with everything Dr. McNamara has stated. It's unfortunate that we are one of the most industrialized countries in the world, that when it comes to hiring police officers, most police departments have very low standards. One need only have a high school diploma, and that's a problem within itself. I mean, I believe, and I think the research supports, but there's a great deal of debate, that it's necessary that a police officer have some college-level education, a bit more education than simply what is received in high school. Consider that when you look at the Diallo situation, we look at the Young situation in Providence, we're talking about a pre-employment process that failed. In other words, when you look at the officers involved in the Diallo case, okay, we have one officer who killed before in a questionable shooting. We have four officers whose behavior has been brought into question before. What I'm
Chris Cooper, we need to take a break here.
Okay, I'd like to pick up.
We'll jump in after the break and talk a little bit more about this. We're talking with Chris Cooper, Joseph McNamara, and Frank Hartman this hour about who's policing the police these days. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI, Public Radio International.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
From
This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Chris Lydon. We're talking this hour about who's policing police departments around the nation following the wave of stories in the news recently about the corruption in Los Angeles and about the controversial and tragic shootings in Providence and New York and elsewhere. Our guests this hour are Frank Hartman, director of the Program on Criminal Justice at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, also Joseph McNamara, former police chief in Kansas City and San Jose, a fellow at the Hoover Institute, Christopher Cooper, a former police officer in Washington and a board member of the National Black Police Association and a police sociologist. And let's pick up where we stopped, where we were just before the break, Frank Hartman. Who's policing the process, the hiring process of police officers? And then once they're wearing the blue, who's policing the police and how?
Well, I'm not aware that anybody's policing the recruitment process. The police try to make distinctions among recruits, and as Joe said, that we clearly don't want somebody who's violent, but the psychological tests aren't very good at discriminating. And invariably, you pick up some people at the margin whom you'd like not to have hired, and as Joe said, it's very difficult to fire those people once you have them, so that departments are working at the recruitment process, and it's essential, but it probably is not as essential given the fact that you never hire more than 5 or 10% of a department in any given year. The issue is, how do you change the behavior of the 90% who have been on for a while? And that's where commonly what's brought into the conversation is civilian review of the police versus internal affairs departments. And traditionally, the police have been totally resistant, almost 100% resistant, to any viewing of police behavior from outside forces. So even in places where you have civilian review of the police, invariably the process is weakened or emasculated by not having subpoena power, or they're not allowed to go into situations in which there's already litigation. So in effect, they're powerless. And so you have nobody policing the police who has any stance or any stake other than the police themselves. The police know how much they are at the margin and how often they can make mistakes. They're like doctors, they're like lawyers. And the fact is they're very wary of anybody judging them. And in a situation when there are crises like the Diallo shooting, they say, oh my goodness, let's just hunker down and this will go away. Let's not have any process that looks at us because they would judge us incorrectly. They would not understand us. So you really don't have very much of a process except going from crisis to crisis. When you have the Christopher Commission in Los Angeles or the commission that was Sinclair Commission in Boston, there really is not much of a process other than internal affairs, which varies widely from department to department and is almost never visible to the outside until you finally get some visibility to the general public without looking to hang or crucify police. You're never going to have anybody adequately watching the police.
What's your short explanation for the resistance to civilian review?
I think it's that police don't trust other people to make judgments of them. So if you police socialize together, how many of have seen two police cars pulled up sort of driver to driver talking to each other? And if you ever dared walk up to those police, you'd be interrupting them. They don't want to be interrupted. Their whole culture tends to make them insular and say, look, we need to be protective. Nobody understands us. And it's just the mentality that until you begin the conversation and know that people would understand that they do make mistakes sometime, that in fact we do have some trust for the good officers, but the whole conversation has to be about trust and legitimacy. And in fact, when I talk about measures and the need for measures, I'm not measuring brutality as much, although I want to measure that, as I'm measuring trust. Every police encounter with a citizen should result in the citizen having increased trust with the police, rather than the rudeness, rather than the disrespect, rather than the abuse that too often happens now. And it only takes one abusive situation for every 10,000 encounters to sort of taint the whole process. And I'm not sure what the ratio is, but the fact is it only takes one bad situation to taint everything. And I'm not going to the bad apple, just a couple of bad apples. But what we're looking for is trust, so that when Chris talked about the attitude of the minority kids, the minority males in community, and their wariness of the police, it's justified. And so police infrequently think about the fact that Boston, I think, is the exception in this. I think Boston is the exception in terms of what it's done via the ministers, via other social organizations to really reach out to kids and to try to get on the same level, to try to understand where they are, to try to treat them with respect. Because finally, until you have the attitude of respect, which generates trust, this is an ongoing situation which never gets resolved.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Let's bring to the connection conversation now Attorney Alan Dershowitz. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. How do you suggest we go about policing the police?
Well, I think it's a much, much bigger problem than has been previously suggested. We send a very mixed message to our police officers. We tell them that the ends justify the means, that it's perfectly acceptable, indeed it's expected of them, that they will lie when lying means that otherwise inadmissible evidence should be let in. We send them a message. And by the way, this is true in all democratic societies. Every democratic society has police scandals. Totalitarian societies never have police scandals because police don't have to lie. But in America, we have Bill of Rights. We have restrictions on search and seizure. We have restrictions on confessions. We don't like them. Politicians certainly don't like them. Judges don't like them. Prosecutors don't like them. And so we make the police the fall guys. And we tell them the only way we can live with the exclusionary rule is if you fib a little bit about seeing that bulge, if you fib a little bit about the initial encounter, if you fib a little bit about the Miranda rules. And so we tell them that the end justifies the means, and then we get outraged when the good lie against the bad guy turns into a bad lie against the good guy, or when the kind of aggressive policing that we really do encourage goes over the line and becomes more aggressive than we'd like. And the policemen are, in many respects, as much the victims as the overt victims, because we are constantly giving them mixed messages. We're perfectly willing to to turn the blame onto them when an overreaction occurs, when I think the blame goes much, much higher up to the mayors and to the sometimes the commissioners and sometimes the judges and the prosecutors. So it's a much broader problem.
Well, what about the citizens? Don't the citizens bear some responsibility for the blame here?
We get the police we deserve. There was a wonderful episode the other night on New York PD Blues, and sometimes popular culture is more reflective of reality than all the pompous politicians posturing. And it had Sipowicz, you know, the great cop on New York PD Blue, telling a young recruit how squad work really works. When you decide it's a bad guy and you haven't given him his Miranda warning, you lie about it. When you have to get evidence admitted in a search, you lie about it. Citizens love that. They don't believe in the exclusionary rules, except when they themselves may be victimized by it. They want to see cops be tough and aggressive, and they don't believe in means. They believe only in ends, the bad guy going off to jail. So we get the police force we deserve as citizens.
Chris Cooper?
Yep.
Where are you on this?
Well, I think that some police officers certainly act of their own volition. I agree with Mr. Dershowitz that you know, we have a police subculture which includes police managers who condone malfeasance. We have a police subculture full of managers who are not very good leaders. However, some officers act of their own volition. Some officers possess sociological baggage that has within it stereotypical notions that all black men are criminals, that all Latino men are criminals, and when we consider that in some cases training is not the issue, in other words, revamping police leadership will not solve the problem, then we accomplish a great deal. We need to look at who we are hiring as police officers. We need to be critical of the psychological process, the pre-employment psychological process that does not probe adequately for sociological baggage that is filled with racist notions which some officers will manifest. And that type of behavior explains why Sergeant Cornell Young is dead right now.
Well, where do we go from here? How do we resolve this? How do you begin to resolve this? How do you change the culture?
Well, first of all, the scholarly community needs to make it very clear to the policymakers that police malfeasance is still a problem. In other words, the scholarly community has to do its duty by talking about it. Don't forget, the policymakers tend to rely on the policy research. And the policy research post-Serpico has said there isn't a problem. Okay? People like myself, people like Mr. Dershowitz have said there is a problem. But then again, do we have a great deal of data? We can't have that much because we don't have the support in the literature. The literature is telling us that the problem is no longer. Let's consider right now what we can do in hiring police officers, how we can better screen applicants, and I think that in that way we can create a situation where we have less problems. One last point. I also think that we need to address use of deadly force policy. We need to talk more about the fact that many officers will shoot according to minimum criteria when dealing with black people. This is an issue that is not discussed often and needs to be brought to the forefront.
Frank Hartman.
I think, I'd challenge the people who negotiate the contracts with the unions periodically to be adamant about the fact that there has to be some kind of ongoing review process that includes more than the police, and let them, the unions, take the lead in trying to design this in a way in which they feel that their interest is served, but the fact is they haven't circled the wagons. I think it's going to take some strong police leaders, some strong mayors, some people who are willing to do the negotiation, because finally you have to have the union on your side, seeing it in their interest to go along and say, we need a review process. So, for example, in Buffalo, the Buffalo school system some years ago, under a union leader named Adam Urbanski, renegotiated the contract between the teachers and the school board. The teachers took on considerable more responsibility in exchange for more money, but one of the responsibilities that the teachers' union took on was counseling bad teachers out of teaching. And so the union itself found a way to say, look, we're all embarrassed by these guys. We don't have to circle the wagons because I make an occasional mistake. Let's get rid of these bad guys. So unions have to be in this conversation. And instead of dragging their heels, the fact is they should be representing the best of policing and saying, look, let's fix this.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. To the Connection listeners now. Bruce, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my comments. I got a few. I'm a retired military NCO, and I had 50 people working for me at one time in the military, and I never had either myself or any of the people that worked for me had near as much trouble as I've had since I've been out of the military. I've been stopped walking down a street for no reason. And I regard a lot of the problems, as having to do with poor training and unprofessional cops. These guys have no sense of community and with the general populace, only with themselves. They have no understanding of minorities, racism. I would consider that as almost a incidental characteristic of a poorly trained cop, is somebody who's racially profiling.
So you feel you've been a victim of racial profiling?
No, actually, I'm white.
Okay.
But what I've seen is in these cases, that's what it all comes down to. I think in the military, because the cops are very well trained, that they don't have that kind of problem. They have. I've had a lot of black guys working for me. I've had women. I've had Hispanics, and there is racism in the military, but I think the cops have been relatively unaffected by it. In terms of a scale with the civilian cops. Another problem they have in civilian cops is there is no independent inquiry. In the military, you have a inspector general who is a semi-disinterested party who can always be complained to about cops or anybody, in the chain of command who oversteps their bounds. And there is nothing like that in civilian life. If the DAs and the cops have this incestuous relationship, and the DAs are afraid to upset the cops because they need the cops' goodwill to do well.
Professor Attorney Alan Dershowitz?
Well, I think one problem as well is that we really have to start increasing the pay available to policemen. We ask them to do such difficult jobs. We ask them to be the basic essential barriers between the bad guys and the rest of us, and we pay them a pittance. Now, salaries are going up a little bit, but they have to go up far more, and we have to be looking to attract better people into the police force as well. Again, we get the police force we deserve. And if we think that we can continue in this time of affluence to pay police the extraordinarily low salaries compared to so many other professions that we pay them, we're going to get some of the people at the margins that previous speakers have commented about. And, we get outraged at the events like the Diallo case and the Yuma case and what's going on in L.A., we have commissions repeatedly. I mean, we've had commissions since the beginning of this century. And the commissions report, and then the politicians tend to ignore the commission reports for the most part, because no politician has ever won an election claiming that he's going to do something which is construed or conceived of as softer on crime. And so it becomes an evil cycle that continues over time. The Christopher Commission, the Mollen Commission, they make their impact and then they go away. And I think politicians realize that the public only has limited patience for listening to these kinds of suggestions for limitations on the police. So I think we have to look at it at a deeper and more fundamental level.
Alan Dershowitz, hang on. Bruce, thanks for your call. Arroyo, you're next on The Connection. Hi there. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. First, I'd like to make a comment that if so much is indeed going wrong, we are all not getting what we deserve. I'd like to make a suggestion that first, peace officers is the difference between peace officers and police officers in terms of what each name means. Further, I think police officers ought to have a community meeting in district courts every 3 months to discuss with supporting evidence the types of programs and trainings going on in their departments, and that nonviolence conflict resolution ought to be part of the peace officers' training.
Chris,
my comment.
Chris Cooper?
I'm actually in Champaign right now conducting a mediation course for patrol police officers. Hopefully, the idea will catch on. Hopefully, more police officers will be required to learn social interaction skills. I mean, there's certainly a police officer should come to a police department with a good foundation. The methodology mediation is very appropriate for use by patrol police officers, since patrol police officers often encounter interpersonal disputes. So hopefully the idea will catch on. The Department of Justice seems to be quite interested. It's been in contact with me, so I think we're going to see more of that type of training.
How difficult is it to teach an officer to be a peace officer as opposed to a police officer?
Well, I think it depends on the department. If you're talking about a department that hires low-quality individuals, in other words, individuals who have average intelligence, individuals who are not very well educated, then you have a very difficult task. Because typically in those types of police departments, the officers have come to the department with a desire to fight crime. They see themselves as crime fighters. And changing that mindset is very, very difficult. In other departments, for instance, here in Champaign, the officers are very well educated. They're welcoming of the methodology mediation. They're welcoming of alternatives other than use of force to resolve citizen disputes.
Well, but wouldn't it be a more difficult task in an urban setting?
No.
And in a college town?
Absolutely not. Absolutely. I'm sorry, what are you saying? An urban setting distinguishable from a college town?
Chicago, Boston, the Bronx.
The Pittsburgh Police Department is the only major city right now that requires its officers to use mediation when possible. And it's working well in Pittsburgh. In fact, city police officers are the most appropriate officers to use the mediation method or to use alternatives to litigation or to use alternatives to conventional ways police officers have been handling situations. And consider that not all police departments hire the lowest quality individual. This problem is a New York City problem. It's an L.A. problem, but there are big cities in America that do a good job of selecting the cream of the crop.
Can I just make one thing? It's interesting that Chris mentions the Pittsburgh Department is using the mediation process and thinking well of that. The Pittsburgh Department had its head handed to it about 5 years ago when the Department of Justice, in effect, put them into receivership. So it may take that kind of action to make a police department pay attention and say we really have a serious problem. So the Department of Justice intervened directly with the Pittsburgh Police Department and got their attention about their failure to police adequately.
But I think it is harder in urban centers. I mean, I think one of the problems is that the Los Angeles police became famous years ago for adopting what in effect was a military model, not a civil liberties model, not a civilian model. And when you have a military model and you recruit into the department former Marines and tell them that they're at war and that when they see gangs, they must treat them as if they're an occupying army, remember that in war, the other side doesn't have rights, whereas we're dealing with citizens. And the military model, the Marine model, the old L.A. model simply can't operate. It may be more efficient, but it is not consistent with a democracy. We have to have a rights model of policing where rights are recognized. And we understand there are bad guys, and there are bad guys with guns, and they have to be dealt with in a way to completely protect the police. That's why I agreed with the acquittal in the Diallo case, even though I think it had it been tried in the Bronx, there might have been a different verdict. But the military model of sending units out, like the street gangs units, aggressively to confront and forget about the rights of defendants is something that we just can't tolerate in a democracy.
Chris Cooper, last word on this?
Last word, perhaps should refer to Mr. Dershowitz's comment regarding the acquittal. Let's consider that the defense did a good job of convincing the jury that the members of the jury were unqualified to sit on the very jury on which they sat. The defense drove home the point that the members of the jury were not qualified to judge police behavior because they were not police officers. Let me say this. As a former police officer, and I know there are many others, we realize that it doesn't take one to be a police officer to judge the behavior of the officers in the Diallo case. Consider that the jury was, in fact, had enough knowledge to realize that these officers overreacted, that these officers used force when they did not know they had to use force. I think there's a real problem in this country with...
And?
with some people telling civilians that they can't judge police behavior.
And I have to cut you off there because I want Frank Hartman to have a last word as well.
Well, I'd refer to the fact that, as Alan says, the commissions come and go and nobody pays any attention. We need some people, some institutions with a stake in the community to really weigh in here. And I think, in fact, it should be the churches with an ongoing interest and pressure for the police to open themselves up.
Frank Hartman, thanks so much for joining us. Also, thanks very much to Chris Cooper and Alan Dershowitz. And earlier in the hour, we were joined by Joseph McNamara. I'm Bob Oakes. In today for Christopher Lydon, this is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation. PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Ink2Me, home to the builders of the Internet infrastructure. Ink2Me, scaling the Internet at INKTOMI.